DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme...
A lot has been done, but a lot more obviously would need to be done to come anywhere near to, say, the ability of the United States to deal with multiple crises around the world. Part of it is about capacity for Europe. Part of it is also about strategic culture. And, of course, there isn't a uniform strategic culture in Europe. But in many places, in many ways, I think there's a great reservation still about using force.
Existential crunch time as the EU seeks a coordinated response to developments in the Middle East. More than just words, Turkey cracks down on trade with Israel. And after the conference that was shut down, comes the one that almost certainly won't be. We'll be talking all things NatCon and CPAC.
I've called this extraordinary meeting of foreign affairs ministers in reaction to the developments in the Middle East over the weekend. You know what I am talking about. I don't have to explain what happened during this weekend, but we need to coordinate our European response.
The EU's High Representative for Foreign Policy and Security, Josep Borrell, there, speaking at a press conference following an emergency video call of the bloc's foreign ministers. At that meeting and the two-day leaders' summit which it preceded, the summit, by the way, is still underway as we record this programme, the need to find a coordinated response to events in the Middle East in the light of Iran's recent aerial attack on Israel was paramount. Whether in the Middle East or Ukraine, Europe, and the EU in particular, is now faced with the challenge of articulating not only a common strategy, but a common sense of mission and purpose in relation to world events, whilst internally it is riven with division. In order to better understand what this moment of existential testing means, I spoke to Ian Lesser, Vice President of the German Marshall Fund, a nonpartisan transatlantic policy think tank headquartered in Washington.
I think, first of all, it's very good to be with you. I think that in terms of a coordinated European response, I think Borrell's point about a coordinated response is the key one. And I don't actually think it would be that difficult to get a coordinated response. Of course, the problem comes when that response becomes more ambitious. And there, I think there are different views in Europe on how hawkish to be on Iran, and in particular, whether to give up on any prospect of reopening the negotiations around restraints on Iran's nuclear capability to revive, in a sense, the previous agreement that the Trump administration withdrew from, which is in many ways still alive, at least on the European side. I think many countries would like to do that. I think there's a fear that if Europe were to go too far in the way of new sanctions, that it would somehow permanently jeopardize the potential for coming back to an agreement on the nuclear front. But I think as far as the ability to come to some sort of a coordinated response, I think I would be fairly optimistic about that.
But I guess for that to happen, there has to be a certain level of agreement, not just in relation to Iran, but also to Israel, too. And there really are big differences within the bloc. Thinking, for example, of the contrast between Germany and Spain's approach to the Middle East, for example.
Well, Spain historically has been more forward-leading than many members of the European Union when it comes to the Palestinian question generally. And is in fact moving towards recognition actually of a Palestinian state. Others in the European Union are much more conservative in this regard. Germany, for understandable historical reasons, has great caution in terms of how it deals with Israeli policy. So there are some very striking differences. Others that have been more forward-leaning include Belgium, for example. But I think when it comes to the question of humanitarian relief in Gaza, I think there's a broad agreement that much more needs to be done.
One thing that Iran's attack on Israel really did make very clear was the effectiveness of the Iron Dome air defense system. Now, Ukraine, of course, is now looking at that and saying, well, if Israel can have it, then why can't we? What are the reservations on that score?
Just to be clear about that, I think the situations are not exactly comparable. The geography is very different. Israel is a small place. The territory to defend in Ukraine is very large. There is a similar need for a kind of multi-layered defense to deal with everything from ballistic missiles to small drones. But there's no one simple system that's going to deal with all of those things. And again, there's a much larger space, a much larger number of targets to protect in Ukraine. And developing those kinds of systems, even to deploy them if they were to be given to Ukraine, takes time. And all of these factors, I think, will come into play. So I understand why people will ask the question about why Israel, but why not Ukraine? But there are some very practical strategic differences.
I suppose whether in relation to the crisis in Ukraine or in the Middle East, there is a sense at the moment that this really is crunch time for Europe. It's time for Europe and the EU in particular to decide what kind of a role it wants to play in the world. Could it be a force for peace, do you think, or is it too internally divided?
I think there have been remarkable shifts in Europe in recent years on this front. The ambition to have a more geopolitical Europe, to have a Europe that can play a bigger role in terms of power projection around the world, or at least not if around the world, at least in the European neighborhood, in its east to the south. A lot has been done, but a lot more obviously would need to be done to come anywhere near to, say, the ability of the United States to deal with multiple crises around the world. Part of it is about capacity for Europe. Part of it is also about strategic culture. And of course, there isn't a uniform strategic culture in Europe. But in many places, in many ways, I think there's a great reservation still about using force.
Do you see signs of that shift happening?
I do see signs of this shift, at least in terms of acquiring the capacity for that sort of action. But of course, it will take a very long time and a lot of investment. There's also been a substantial shift in terms of the political discourse about this. But is it enough to allow Europe to play anything near the kind of role that the United States has been willing to play in recent years? Probably not, or at least not for a very long time to come. Again, there are real differences in Europe on this score. France, the UK have somewhat different traditions in this regard. Others are much more restrained. And I think it will take a lot of leadership and a lot of change, really, in societies to change the way Europe approaches the world when it comes to the use of force. And we're not really there yet.
Finally, I was wondering, I mean, we all know that thing about the US seeing itself as the world's policeman. I was wondering what you think Europe sees itself as.
Well, Europe, I think, has seen itself as a values power, as a soft power, as a place that was exporting not so much stability as a kind of way of thinking about politics and economy and security that was based on its own model inside Europe, which was, after all, after the Second World War, in large measure, a peace project. So I think that's deeply embedded in certainly the European Union idea of itself, that it was exporting values as much as anything else. I think that's still true, but of course that may no longer be enough in its own right.
Ian Lesser is Vice President of the German Marshall Fund of the United States. He was speaking to me ahead of the German Marshall Fund's Brussels Forum, held this year on the 18th and 19th of April at Hotel La Plaza and live streamed on the Brussels Forum website. Middle East policy is being hotly discussed in Turkey too, where the government has announced restrictions on trade with Israel, whilst flights have also been suspended. The move comes in the aftermath of municipal and mayoral elections, which saw sweeping electoral defeats for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AKP party. During the campaign, the opposition criticised the country's ongoing trade with Israel as condemnation grows over Israel's war in Gaza, which has seen over 33,000 Palestinians killed, most of them civilian, and where aid agencies warn that famine is now taking hold. From Istanbul, Dorian Jones reports.
On Istanbul's main high street, the latest protests against Turkish trade with Israel. While Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has taken the lead in slamming Israel for its war on Hamas, trade between the countries has continued. But under mounting public pressure, Turkish Airlines announced that it will not resume flights to Israel until March next year. While Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan also announced further sanctions against Israel.
Biz de hava kuvvetlerimize ait kargo uçaklarıyla Bu insani yardım operasyonuna
we have submitted our request to join this aid operation with cargo planes belonging to our Air Force. We learned today that our request was rejected by Israel. There can be no excuse for Israel preventing our attempt to send aid to our Gazan brothers who are fighting hunger. In response to this situation, we've decided to take a series of new measures against Israel.
UNCRA has banned the export to Israel of 54 products, including aviation fuel, steel and cement. Fidan said the export ban would remain in force until Israel declares a ceasefire and allows unhindered aid deliveries. Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, condemned the Turkish moves, accusing UNCRA of supporting Hamas, warning of retaliation. Soli Özel teaches international relations at Istanbul's Kadir Has University. He says the Turkish measures are a sign Turkey's ruling AK Party stance of condemning Israel's war on Hamas but maintaining normal trade relations is becoming untenable.
The hypocrisy of the government in that Turkey sells to Israel steel and other things that can be used for the war machine. You have all these AKP-related businesses or AKP politicians very closely, intimately trading with Israel and stuff. They had to respond somewhat. They had to show that they were doing something. And the best, most effective and most visible way of doing it would be to suspend Turkish Airlines flights, of which I think there must be over 30. And as I said, this was supposed to be one of the most profitable lines that Turkish Airlines operated.
Last month, the opposition inflicted on Erdogan's AK party its worst electoral defeat in nationwide local elections.
Katil Siyonist İsrail'le halen daha ihracatın...
The Islamist Yeniden Refah Party, led by Fatih Erbakan, son of Erdogan's former political mentor, Necmettin Erbakan, focused his campaign on condemning the Turkish president for continuing to trade with Israel. The fringe party was rewarded taking control of several local strongholds of Erdogan's AK party. İşdar Gözaydın, a Turkish religion and state relations specialist at Istanbul's İstinye University, says Erbakan now poses a severe threat to the religious base of Erdogan's AK party.
The son of Necmettin Erbakan, Fatih Erbakan, is once again an important figure, apparently. I think sort of the end is near for AKP, but I guess it will be replaced by the Yeniden Refah Partisi, which is headed by Fatih Erbakan.
Turkish social media is inundated by videos of the secular and religious condemning trade with Israel. However, Galia Lindenstrauss, an analyst with the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv, says such interaction is vital to maintaining bilateral ties at times of diplomatic tension.
It's unprecedented that for so long there's no flights from Turkey to Israel and from Israel to Turkey. And that's a damage. That's a damage to the relationship because, of course, also for business relationship, it's very important to have a regular transport route, even in points of tension between Israel and Turkey. And we've had points of tensions. So there were things that kept the relations going, even though the political relations were in crisis. And one element was the economic relations. And part of this was also the transport connections between Turkey and Israel and the fact that the people relations were enabled.
Even when Israeli forces in 2010 killed 10 Turkish citizens delivering aid by ship to Gaza, flights and trade between the countries were unaffected. But international relations expert Özel says given the magnitude of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, this time could be different.
This is a goddamn massacre that's going on for 6 months that people are watching live. And this is truly unconscionable. The level of protest on this particular issue of trading with Israel has increased as the devastation became even worse. So this is of a different order, I really think.
Protests in Turkey against trade with Israel are likely to continue, if not grow, with Israeli forces poised to launch a new offensive into Gaza, which can only add further pressure on Erdogan. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
A quick reminder at this point that you can subscribe to the Inside Europe podcast on all the usual platforms. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Event is creating public disturbance and therefore it will be closed down gradually.
That was the moment this week at which visitors to the National Conservative NatCon conference in Brussels were told that police were shutting down their event. The conference, organised by the US National Conservative think tank the Edmund Burke Foundation, gathered leading figures of the European hard right together, including the Dutch politician Geert Wilders, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban and British firebrand Nigel Farage. A loud critic of so-called cancel culture, many journalists noted Farage's apparent glee at the unexpected turn of events.
I'm used to being treated badly, but what happened today to me and everybody else that expresses the view that ever closer political union is not a desirable goal is, I think, truly reminiscent, in many ways, of the old Soviet Union.
It should be noted here that the Brussels police were acting on the orders of a local mayor and that the Prime Minister of Belgium took swiftly to social media to condemn the intervention as unacceptable. The conference was able to continue the next day when Brussels' highest court overruled the municipal closure order. Nevertheless, the damage had been done, and what might have been an unremarkable Brussels sideshow had become national news in many countries, including Hungary, which is due to host its own right-wing gathering next week, featuring many of the same guests. CPAC, or the Conservative Political Action Conference, is the annual rally of the US American right. But in 2022, Hungary began hosting a European iteration. Rather like the NatCon conference in Brussels, analysts are seeing this as part of an ongoing attempt by right-wing hardliners in Europe to mimic the populist strategies and successes of their Trumpian counterparts across the Atlantic. To learn more, I spoke to our Budapest correspondent Stefan Boss. After the Brussels NatCon fiasco, I asked him what kind of a reception could visitors to CPAC in Hungary expect?
Well, it's an interesting question. I'm not expecting Hungary's police to break up CPAC. Hungary's powerful Prime Minister Orbán will be even a keynote speaker there, so I don't think he will allow that. And it's also the third time that CPAC will be held in Budapest. Now, in Orbán's view, Hungary has become a beacon of conservatism and Christianity in Europe, and of course, Trumpianism, if you will. He made that clear when talking to supporters in the United States.
You should know that I am an old-fashioned freedom fighter. I am also the longest-serving prime minister in Europe, the only anti-migration political leader on our continent.
Hungary's Viktor Orbán there. Other familiar figures from your beat, Stefan, will be popping up as well. The anti-Islam politician Geert Wilders from your native Netherlands.
Well, indeed, Geert Wilders is widely expected to participate at the conference. And one of the reasons is, of course, that Geert Wilders shares many of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's views. He fiercely opposes more migration and regards Islam as a dangerous ideology. And of course, his Party for Freedom, the PVV party, won last year's elections in the Netherlands. Now, that victory was not unnoticed in Hungary, recalled Geert Wilders.
I had a phone conversation with Viktor Orbán, who called me I know him already for a long time, so but still called me and congratulated me.
Wilders knows Orbán very well, Kate, and he has also close ties with Hungary. And that's also, I think, in part because his longtime wife is Hungarian.
Things not looking quite so rosy for him at home, though, at the moment, Stefan. This is a little bit of an aside, but there are the real problems in the Netherlands, right?
Yes, indeed, because it's getting very difficult for him to form a government. I mean, they are already talking for about almost a half a year now, I would say. So it's really getting difficult to come up with a coalition government. So we have to see how that will work out in the coming weeks.
And meanwhile, in Hungary, as we've been reporting, there have been big anti-government protests in the streets, stemming most recently from allegations of corruption. But really, Viktor Orban's troubles began a few months ago with the paedophile pardoning scandal that toppled not only his president, but also his Minister of Justice. Do you think that this CPAC conference could be a way for him to shift the narrative, to remove attention from these scandals and place it elsewhere?
I think it is, especially ahead of the upcoming European Union elections in June. He wants to show his electorate that he is still in charge and that he will overcome the cries for change, if you will, on the streets of Budapest and beyond. Also, I think it is a message from Prime Minister Viktor Orban to US President Joe Biden that Hungary won't be isolated, despite the Biden administration's fierce criticism of Viktor Orban's perceived authoritarian style and also concerns about the rule of law here. Orban has made clear he would like to see former US President Donald J. Trump back in the White House. Both claim to be friends and close political allies, so we have to see how that will play out.
Well, as we know, Stefan, the Brussels event really became overshadowed by the attempts of the Brussels authorities to shut it down. That's not going to happen in Hungary. So what is it then that the organisers are really hoping to achieve?
Well, I think definitely they would like to see the conference going more smoothly than in Belgium, also because Miklos Szanto, he's the founder of CPAC Hungary and the director of the Conservative Center for Fundamental Rights, wants the gathering to rally really against what he views as the dangerous leftist liberals undermining Europe's Christian Judeo traditions. Now, he also hopes leaders from several nations will share the Hungarian government's views. This is what he said.
The problem of the deep state in Europe, that's called Brussels and the European Union, and the problem of the Biden administration with Hungary is that, as I mentioned, it firmly stands up for the three values of God, homeland and family.
Yet, Kate, don't expect, I have to say, an open mind for debate. I know for a fact that independent and critical journalists have been banned from the gathering. Even Dutch media are not welcome, despite Geert Wilders being a keynote speaker there.
Have you been banned, Stefan?
Well, yes, because I'm already for a long time on the blacklist, which was published by the government, or at least a medium very close to the government. And you know, I'm not the only one. There are several more journalists being banned, so we are definitely not welcome at this gathering.
Our Budapest correspondent, Stefan Voss there, definitely not a candidate for the Inside Europe blacklist. This is Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
Thank you.
is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Coming up in the next half hour, Denmark's Notre Dame, Copenhagen's historic stock exchange, burns down. State in a smartphone, what the world can learn from Ukraine's Dear app. Teflon politics, why Icelanders overwhelmingly disapprove of their new PM. And deep breath, we're off to the International Festival of the Ocarina.
From the studios of Germany's international broadcaster, DW, this is Inside Europe.
This is our Notre Dame. This is our national treasure.
I'm lost for words. It's a 400-year-old building that has survived all the other fires that burned down Copenhagen to the ground.
It was built by Christian IV 400 years ago, and it was the center for trade in Northern Europe for 400 years.
This week, residents of Denmark's capital, Copenhagen, looked on in horror as fire consumed the city's historic stock exchange building. Reporter Adrian Murray was there, bearing witness to what's already being called Denmark's Notre Dame moment.
The fire had broken out early on Tuesday morning, and within no time at all, orange flames and plumes of thick grey smoke were billowing from the historic former stock exchange in the very heart of Copenhagen. Scores of firefighters raced to control the inferno as it quickly ripped through the 17th century building. Called Børsen, it's one of the city's best-known landmarks. And onlookers watched in shock as its tall spire, famous for the four dragons that wrap around it, burned and plummeted from the roof. Scenes that many compared to the dramatic fire at Paris's Notre Dame Cathedral that had taken place 5 years ago, almost to the day. Neighbouring the Danish Parliament, the old stock exchange was built in 1625 by one of the country's most powerful kings, Christian IV, with red bricks, a teal-green copper roof, and an interior richly decorated with fine wood carvings and works of art. It's one of the country's most significant buildings, a symbol of Denmark's identity as a trading nation. Copenhageners were left stunned by the loss of Børsen's dragon spire from the city's picture postcard skyline, a sight that many people walked or cycled past almost daily. There's been a public outpouring, with many people sharing their photos of Børsen on social media, and the royal family, who had planned to mark Queen Margrethe's birthday, toned down their celebrations. Copenhagen's mayor, Sophie Hastrup Andersen, told reporters that 400 years of cultural history had been lost. However, there were also astonishing scenes, as emergency workers and even passers-by ran towards the fire, helping to rescue precious artworks from inside. At least a few hundred of the most valuable artefacts have been saved, including centuries-old furniture and priceless paintings. The first pictures from inside show a gutted, torched shell. Half the building has been destroyed and the remainder is badly damaged. But there's already talk of rebuilding. And in a sign of hope, the fire crew recovered the ornamental metal tip from its spire and gave it to Brian Mikkelsen, the director of the Danish Chamber of Commerce, which owns the building. The stock exchange must be rebuilt, he said, no matter what.
Adrian Murray in Copenhagen there. The state in a smartphone. That's how Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky described the country's digital government app, Dear, back in 2019. Since then, of course, life in Ukraine has been brutally upturned by Russia's full-scale invasion. But the app remains as important as ever. Much more important, in fact. As of the end of last year, 100% of major public services have been grouped online, with the digitalisation enabling citizens in the war-torn country to continue to be able to do such things as prove their identity, apply for a new passport, and open a bank account. But the Dear app has other functions too, such as crowdsourcing military intelligence. Ben Batke has been taking a closer look.
From the first days of the invasion, Ukraine showed mastery on the digital front chatbot, Yevrog, e-enemy in the Telegram messenger.
This chatbot turns Ukrainian civilians into digital resistance fighters. Set up just 8 days after Russia attacked, it lets anyone submit military intelligence. Here's Valeria Ionan, Ukraine's Deputy Minister of Digital Transformation.
E-Enemy, which helps citizens to inform our armed forces about Russian troops and Russian equipment.
Over the past 2 years, more than 500,000 Ukrainians have used the app, Yonan says. Among other things, civilian intelligence has led to strikes on Russian bases in occupied territory.
The main difference from all other existing bots is authorization through DIA app. Only citizens of Ukraine are able to use the bot, submits them to the headquarters of armed forces of Ukraine.
Ivorok uses another government app, DIA, to check users' identity. Over the first weeks and months of Russia's invasion, Ukraine's Ministry of Digital Transformation quickly rolled out several other war-related services on the DIA app. Yonan says the digital government app helped the country remain functional.
Widely adopted eGov app helps to boost countries' resilience, especially during wartime. And we have a lot of examples like the possibility to obtain ADP status just in 2 clicks with the direct social financial assistance.
Launched in early 2020, DIA served as a one-stop shop for digital documents already before Russia's full-scale invasion.
What is DIA? DIA is a state-in smartphone. Ukraine is the first country in the world that allows its citizens to use digital passports as an alternative to physical ones, using which you can open a bank account in 1 click and travel around the country without originals.
Meaning action in Ukrainian, DIA is currently used by some 20 million Ukrainians. They can prove their identity, pay taxes, sign digital documents, or register a business among over 100 digital services.
All the communication that citizens have with the government should be like the communication through Bolt, Uber, Booking, or any other IT startup. And that's exactly what DIA does. You can pay fines in 2 clicks, you can pay taxes in 2 clicks.
DIA is supposedly secure by design as it only stores depersonalized data. But experts say they cannot independently evaluate its cybersecurity or personal data protection.
For decades, Ukrainians had to deal with corruption that permeated state institutions. DIA set out to fix that. In 2 first years, DIA saved 16.3 billions of state budget and 20.5 thousand.
Aside from helping accelerate digitalization, eGov apps are also said to reduce corruption. According to Ionan, the automation of construction permits helps Ukraine save 1.5 billion Ukrainian hryvnia, the equivalent of 37 million euros each year.
When you are digitizing sphere, which was traditionally very corrupted, you not only save money for the state budget, but you also save the human hours and you completely change the way of communication between government and citizens and make it more human-centric.
Ukraine is a role model for other countries, including Ethiopia, Zambia and Ecuador, interested in adopting DIA-like solutions, according to the U.S. Agency for International Development, which funded part of the development of DIA.
We set this great collaboration, and this is really important. This is a picture of the teams working together.
Even eGov pioneer Estonia turned to Ukraine to build its own state super app. Called mRiik, it is expected to be released in the coming months. Lukas Ilves was Estonia's chief information officer until February.
We've built an MVP, a trial version of the app that has a lot of the experience from building DIA, that has some of the code, that has some of the design approaches. What we're doing right now is working on how a chatbot can conversationally let you use services. So you start having a text, an SMS exchange, or in the chatbot when you're saying, hey, I want to renew my passport. You're not just getting information saying, here's where you do it and here's the link. You actually do the live renewal in the chat and it asks what's the address it should send you to.
Adopting a digital government app is no surefire success. Digital literacy, internet penetration, smartphone user rates, and security mechanisms, among other things, are all important factors. So what's next for the DIA ecosystem? Starting in April, the mRiia app, Ukrainian for Dream, will tailor educational content to Ukrainians' professional needs.
This application will give the opportunity for a user to receive personalized learning trajectories from preschool to the lifelong learning.
DIA has not only been a remarkable example of Ukraine's resilience and ingenuity in the face of adversity, it also highlights one possible path for Ukraine's future economy. While the country was dominated by agriculture and heavy industry before the war, government officials like Valeria Ionan now see technology's potential as a key pillar. But given the grim reality in the analog world, the dream of DIA being a harbinger of Ukraine's bright post-war digital future is anything but certain. Ben Bartke, DW.
Whilst we're talking about apps, a quick plug here for DW's Breaking News app, which is available in a variety of different languages. Now, last week, Iceland got a new prime minister, and this week he's in trouble already. The coalition government appointed Bjarni Benediktsson as prime minister after the previous PM, Katrin Jakobsdottir, stepped down in order to run in upcoming presidential elections. An online petition expressing Icelanders' dissatisfaction with the choice has since garnered some 40,000 signatures, representing well over 10% of the population, although a parliamentary vote of no confidence was blocked with 35 votes to 25. So, who is Bjarni Benediktsson, and why do Icelanders appear to dislike him so much? To find out, I rang up Iceland's longest-running English-language magazine, The Iceland Review, who put me in touch with journalist Andy Sophia Fontaine.
Well, he's the chair of the Independence Party, and I think it's fair to say both his allies and his foes alike would describe him as kind of untouchable. It doesn't seem like anything ever sticks to him, no matter what. And he's had a very colorful career with a lot of ups and downs, and through it all, he seems to always come out on top. He leads the Independence Party, which is Iceland's center-right conservative party. We don't really have any solidly right-wing parties, I would say. And the Independence Party is Iceland's second oldest living political party.
So if he is Mr. Teflon, why Yes. is it that he seems to be so unpopular? I mean, at the moment, we've got a petition. Last time I looked, signatures were around the 40,000 mark. I mean, that doesn't sound like a lot, but when you think that Iceland's population is what, 360?
Yeah. 360, yeah. Roughly 360.
So we're at, you know, well over 10% of the population.
And an even greater percentage of the electorate.
How much of the electorate?
It's a little over 30% of the electorate.
Wow. So this is, these numbers are really significant. There was also a survey that showed a 78% disapproval rating right. for him. What's he done? Why do people dislike him so much?
It's really interesting. If you go onto Iceland's official website for parliament, every single member of parliament has their CV and their history up on the website. And Bjarni's CV is very interesting because he's held a lot of ministerial positions. He's been in parliament since 2003. His father, Benedikt Sveinsson, is a Supreme Court barrister, and his father before him was also a member of parliament. He was born and raised in Garðabær, which is a town that has like a very solid base for the Independence Party. So in a lot of ways, it seems like Bjarni Benediktsson was kind of destined for this role, you know? But scandal has followed him in no small part because of his father, interestingly enough. And see, the most recent example, and you have to bear with me here, is in 2017, we had a government that went into a crisis over a little something called Uppreist æru in Icelandic, which literally means restored honor. It's a very strange legal concept, which is basically that if a person has committed a crime and they have a criminal record and say they want to apply for a job such as, I don't know, lawyer, where normally a criminal record would prevent them from getting that position, they can apply for restored honor and they don't have their criminal record expunged, but that stuff on their criminal record will no longer get in the way of them being able to hold a position where a criminal record would normally hold them back. Okay? So in 2017, a man named Robert Downey had applied for restored honor and received it. Robert Downey had done some very bad things, specifically against children. And it turns out that one of the people who wrote a recommendation letter for him was none other than Bjarni Benediktsson's father. And at that time, Bjarni Benediktsson was Minister of Justice. And this contributed to tensions between the Independence Party and Bright Future, which was the other party that they were in the government with at the time. And Bright Future broke up the government. They had new elections. And Bjarni is again back in parliament. And through the negotiations between the left-green movement, the Progressive Party, and the Independence Party, he ends up Minister of Finance. And as you may remember from the crash in 2008, Iceland's three top banks were nationalized. And ever since then, pieces of them have been privatized. So some shares in Landsbanki were for sale, and as Minister of Finance, Bjarni Benediktsson was responsible for overseeing who was buying shares and either approving or rejecting the sale. One of these companies who bought shares in this bank was a company owned by, again, Bjarni Benediktsson's father. And he explained this by saying that he didn't know his father owned this company and he doesn't really talk to his father all that much. He stepped down then in 2023. He resigned, but he became the foreign minister instead. And the foreign minister at that time became finance minister. They simply switched seats.
And then, of course, he becomes prime minister because Katrin Jakobsdottir has to resign when she decides to run for president. I mean, it does seem extraordinary. If I were to take a walk with you through Reykjavik right now, what would people be saying? Would people be talking about this? How big is the outrage?
Yeah, it's staying in the news cycle. But to be clear, like the petition is not saying Bjarni Benediktsson resign. But the petition is saying we do not think Bjarni Benediktsson is fit to be prime minister. And it's a petition, you know, it's not a legally binding referendum per se. And so he can ignore it. The entire government can ignore it if they want to. The Independence Party historically are generally the last people to be swayed by polls. Like in 2008, for example, when the crash happened, there were two parties in government, the Social Democrats and the Independence Party. Okay. So massive protests every single day. It was, you know, international headlines, the pots and pans revolution. It wasn't the Independence Party who decided, you know what, this doesn't work, we should break up the government. It was the Social Democrats. Like the day after the economy collapsed, the very first matter that the Independence Party wanted to talk about in Parliament, and this is the Monday after the banks crashed, they wanted to bring up the discussion about selling alcohol in grocery stores and corner shops. So I don't think that like they're going to break up the government over this. I mean, stranger things have happened in Iceland. We have a really colorful political history, but I don't see it happening. And in terms of it harming them politically, no. I mean, one thing that's important to understand about the Independence Party is that they're more than a political party. They're the second oldest surviving political party in the country. But they're more than this. They're a way of life almost. Like they have hereditary voters. They are a way of life. They're a cultural movement in a lot of ways. And they're not disappearing because of this.
Andy Sophia Fontaine is a journalist with Iceland Review. Go to icelandreview.com for extensive coverage of this topic, including a profile of the man himself. A big shout out here to Inside Europe listener Pal Olafsson, who reached out to us via the insideeurope.com address and gave us some helpful pointers on the story, as well as some top-notch Icelandic banter. Thank you, Pal, son of Olafur. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. We have the International Festival of the Ocarina coming up in just a minute, so whilst we're on unusual events...
This week, the Olympic torch began its journey to Paris. Nothing unusual about that. But what we want to know in this week's quiz question is this. Which new sport will feature in this year's Olympics for the first time? Is it chess, breakdance, tug of war, or club swinging? If you think you know, head on over to Spotify to take part in the poll. To the International Festival of the Ocarina now, ongoing until Sunday in the little Italian town of Budrio, just outside of Bologna. What, such a small venue for such a prestigious event, some of you may be thinking? Others of you may be wondering, ocarina, what's that? Well, I can tell you that it is a tiny wind instrument said to look like a large potato with holes in it to make the notes. It was invented in the 1800s in Budrio, there's the answer to that question, and although not well known in Italy, it is played in the US, China and Korea. Over to Danny Mitzman.
The Korean Ocarina Orchestra are getting a guided tour of the Ocarina Museum from its official guide, Fabio Galliani. Fabio's been playing the ocarina since he was 10 and has performed with the Gruppo Ocarinistico Budriese Septet for over 40 years. They regularly tour the Far East, playing 2,000-seat concert halls in Japan.
They ask why it is not so popular in Europe. Because it's a pocket instrument, quite easy to play. In China, it's the instrument for the children. In Japan, it's the instrument for the retired people. Poi invece abbiamo messo l'ocarina.
The ocarina was invented in 1853 by local musician Giuseppe Donati when he was just 17 and worked in a brick factory. At night, while keeping the kiln fire stoked, he would fashion whistles out of clay in the shapes of animals. The name ocarina means little goose in Budrio dialect, and they're still made the same way they were over 150 years ago.
It's special to have a beautiful sound, a sound that makes you dream. And the people that listen you dream also with you, listening this pure sound, very natural sound, like a sound of birds.
Fabio's delighted the festival's back after a five-year absence.
I think this is the magic of Ocarina Festival, that you can listen to Ocarina sound everywhere downtown Budrio. Now there is a rehearsal of a Korean group in the theater.
Like almost every Korean is crazy about ocarina now. It's really interesting. Popularity is really interesting, very, very fast. And also, like all the Koreans in elementary school learn ocarina in basically from first grade to third grade, yeah.
Kim Chu-hyang's part of the 22-piece Korean Ocarina Orchestra. He says Korea discovered the instrument just 10 years ago from Japan, where it's been popular since the 1980s. Another of the international performers in Budrio for her third time is Jinya Liu from Beijing.
Well, let me see. I started playing ocarina in 2007. I was still a college student. I just saw a person who sold ocarina in the mini store, and I wasn't sure what it is. It's like a toy or something like that. And just give it a try. He told me this is an instrument. I said, "What? I can't believe that's a musical instrument. It's incredible." So I give it a try. Well, wow, sounds beautiful.
When Jinya started, there was just a handful of ocarina players in China.
We used to have a very small party, like only 30 people get together as the first ocarina party in China. And now we have millions of people playing ocarina in China.
Jinya now lives in the USA, having married an American ocarina enthusiast she met here in Budrio.
Right now I have over 100 ocarina, so my home is like a mini ocarina museum. And ocarina is amazing. It can be all different shapes. So one is never enough. 10, not enough. 100, no, you can always get more.
Wow. And there are plenty of myriad sizes, styles and colours to tempt Jingya and her husband at the market.
So these ones here are raku. So basically after firing them initially, I glaze them and I fire them again in a gas kiln. I pull them out with like tongs at 1800 degrees and I put it in a bin. And that basically, that thermal shock causes the glaze to crack. And then the bin that I put it in, there's like a lot of like paper and things.
American Austin Dress has been making ceramic ocarinas for 13 years.
Like a lot of people in the West, I was originally introduced to it by a video game series, Legend of Zelda. There's a character who plays this instrument. And I found out that it was real. I had no idea of, I guess, the cultural significance of it in Italy until I, you know, found out that it was like a real instrument you could play. So
you thought it was just invented for the game at first?
Initially, yes, yeah.
What makes the ocarina special in your opinion?
I think it's really just the pure tone of it. I think that's what draws a lot of people to it, just this very like sine wave, pure tone sound. So just very calming.
And I think that unique sound is really what, you know, gets people like, ooh, what's this? We kind of want this in, you know, our music.
Professional clarinetist and saxophonist Stephen Higby's been playing the ocarina for 8 years and is thrilled to be in the instrument's birthplace.
It feels amazing. I've only been really in the U.S., so exploring a whole other country, a whole other culture has been really exciting. Not only that, it's weird seeing other ocarina players because there isn't too many ocarina players near I am, because there's sometimes we'll have like meetups where it's only like, you know, 10 people or so. But being able to meet, you know, hundreds of people who all play ocarina is just an otherworldly experience. So recently, one of the things I was able to play ocarina on was a Minecraft DLC, Dungeons & Dragons. I was asked by the composer to play ocarina for that. So it's kind of cool seeing that there's more and more demand starting to build up for it.
So much international interest has awoken Budrio to its musical heritage, and the town's school children all now learn to play the ocarina. Local pastor Stefano Mariotti's noticed a big change in attitude at this year's festival.
There was a whole concert on the music from the anime, from the Japanese cartoons, played with the ocarina to attract the younger generation. They are really into anime and cosplay and all that. But also they played ocarina in a discotheque. So there was a DJ playing modern music with the ocarina and partnering together. So they really get into that.
Stefano's been accompanying his friend and fellow pastor, Ed Mezzetti, to meet local school children today.
So I've been looking after them carefully.
So they're just in your backpack? Ah, they're nicely, carefully.
Carefully wrapped.
Ed's a descendant of two brothers who were members of the original Ocarina Septet that toured Europe in the 1800s, performing in historic venues like London's Crystal Palace. Ed's from England because his great-great-grandfather moved to London to sell the ocarinas his brother made.
It's just intriguing to have these old instruments and then to realise actually the significance, because right here, this is the heartland of the ocarina, and hearing people have travelled from all around the world because they love ocarinas. And somehow that is linked to my own family. I think it's just really quite moving to see.
I was going to try and think up something funny to say at the end of Danny Mitzman's report there, but I'm afraid I'm just all out of puff. Time to go, I think. This programme was produced by me, Kate Laycock, with help from Nick Martin and sound engineer Ziad Abu Sleiman. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.